Section 2, Indian Life and Cultures. As you read, look for how Native Americans provided for themselves with food, shelter, clothing, and transportation, the religious beliefs and practices of Native Americans, the games and other forms of recreation that enriched Native Americans' lives, the social organization of the clan and tribe in a matrilineal society, Native American systems of justice and rules of warfare, the lives of women and children in Native America, terms, maize, wigwam, wattle, daub, green corn ceremony, matrilineal, nation. Historians and archaeologists make many general statements about Indian life in a certain era, but it is necessary to keep in mind that there was amazing variety among the different Indian groups in America. A rough estimate of the number of Indians scattered across what is now the United States in 1492, when Columbus arrived, is between 2 and 18 million. They were divided into hundreds of tribes and language groups. Each of these tribes had adapted to the environment in which the group lived. The people developed lifestyles satisfying the tribe's needs. In the area that was to become South Carolina, there were between 30 and 50 tribes in four major language groups when Europeans first arrived here in the early 1500s. Any general statement made about their culture may not be true for one or more tribes. The traits described here are those that apply to most tribes and groups. The economy. The economy of a society refers to the process by which the people use the natural resources available to them to provide for their survival and well-being. They apply labor to those resources and use technology, tools, and ways of getting work done to make their labor more effective. Perhaps the most important information we need about a group of people in order to understand them is, how do they provide for themselves? How do they make a living? Food. The Indians of South Carolina were very different from the Indians of the Great Plains area, which are commonly stereotyped in movies. They were not nomadic hunters following the buffalo herds. Indians in this area were farmers and hunters who lived in settled communities. Agriculture was most important in their economy. The farmers grew maize, corn, beans and peas of several sorts, squash, sunflowers, and pumpkins. To supplement their diet, they foraged for wild crops such as strawberries, peaches, herbs, roots, bulbs, and hickory nuts, which were used for cooking oil. The farmers also grew tobacco, which they smoked in clay pipes. Each family had garden plots, and the village had large common fields that were tilled communally, by all, for all. At planting time, an elder would call the villagers, both male and female, to labor in the fields. They tilled the soil with hoes made of sharp bones or conch shells lashed to poles. The crops were planted in hills or clumps, not in rows. Corn and beans were grown in the same hills so the bean vines could climb on the corn stalks. After planting, the men left the tending of crops to the women and children. They were to keep the birds from eating the seeds and prevent wild animals from eating the plants as they grew. The men's work consisted mainly of hunting, fishing, and, at times, making war. The Catawba called themselves the people of the river, and they depended on fish as a main source of food. They built weirs or fences in the river to help catch fish. The hunter's principal prey among most tribes was deer, elk, bear, wild turkey, raccoons, geese, ducks, and a variety of smaller game. The bow and arrow was their main weapon. Firearms, of course, came later with the Europeans. Boys hunted birds and squirrels with blowguns. Along the coast, shellfish were also an important part of the diet. The coast dwellers are good examples of Indians' use of a variety of food sources. On the seacoast, they harvested oysters and clams. In the swamps, they collected roots. They used inland fields for farming and forest for hunting deer, turkey, and other game. Most Indian groups struck a fair balance among farming, hunting, fishing, and gathering to meet their basic needs. They used a variety of ecosystems, thus not being too dependent on any one source of food and not exhausting any one source. Today, we would call that excellent management of resources. Shelter. The houses built in the villages were sturdy buildings, but differed according to tribe and area. The most typical dwelling in the coastal plain was the wigwam, a circular or oblong house made of long saplings covered with bark. The Catawba in the Midlands and the Yamassee in the Lowcountry used this technique extensively. Even more substantial houses were built by the tribes in the upcountry. Many were of wattle and daub construction. The wattle was the post of the walls, interwoven with smaller twigs. The daub was the clay or mud used to fill in the gaps in the wattle and form a smooth surface inside and out, making for a very warm and cozy cabin. These cabins could be quite large, some measuring up to 16 by 60 feet. Some even had two stories. The roof was usually made of thatch, straw or grass, or bark. The Cherokee used wattle and daub construction, but also built log cabins after they were introduced by Europeans. The walls were made of thick logs, stripped of bark, and notched at both ends so they would fit tightly together. The log walls were covered with clay mixed with grass inside and outside. The roof was of bark or large shingles. These cabins were often large and divided into rooms. Outside many of these dwellings, there were sweat lodges, good for cleaning the body and the soul. Every village had a public building constructed with similar techniques as the individual houses, but much larger. This was the council house or town hall. Here the leaders of the clan or tribe met to discuss and decide issues important to the community. The building was also used for social and recreational activities, a sort of community center. In larger villages and those with religious significance, the council house and a temple might be built on a large earthen mound, giving them much more prominence. A temple mound was built like a flat-topped pyramid with a ramp on one side to allow easy access. With no pack animals and no carts with wheels, the men had to carry, in baskets on their backs, all the dirt for building the mounds. Often a chief's house would be built on the mound, in addition to the temple and town hall. When a chief died, his house might be burned, the ashes covered with a fresh layer of dirt, and a new chief's house built upon it. Completing the architecture of the village was the wall around the perimeter. This palisade of poles, sharpened at the tops, loomed 10 to 20 feet in height and helped protect the village from enemy attack. Clothing. Apparently, when weather allowed, many Indians chose to wear no clothes, or perhaps a breech cloth for the men and an apron for the women. They solved the problem of biting insects by rubbing their bodies with bear oil. Paintings and tattoos on their bodies were also common. Many of the clothes for cooler weather were made of deer skin or bear skin. The skins were prepared by soaking them in a mixture of deer brains and water. After a good scraping with oyster shells or rocks, and being cured with smoke over a slow fire, the skins were soft, pliable leather, ready to sew with deer sinews, tendons. Cloth was handwoven from animal hair, usually bear or possum, and from various plant fibers. The cloth was used to make shirts, skirts, pants, robes, blankets, breech cloths, and aprons, to name only a few. On the coast, Spanish moss was used to fashion robes for women. Any of the clothing might be decorated with woven geometrical designs, shells, dyes, feathers, belts, and other added features. Jewelry was also used to adorn the body and clothes. Among the ornamentation were earrings, necklaces, headbands, and armbands featuring animal teeth or claws, stones, copper pieces, and shells of many varieties. Transportation. Indians, before European contact, had no wheels and no horses. The American horse of Paleo-Indian times became extinct thousands of years ago. Transportation was by foot or water. That is one of the reasons most Indian villages were near rivers. The main transportation on water was provided by dugout canoes. The canoes were important for the extensive trade among various tribes and villages. But the impressive number and length of foot trails indicates that much travel and trade took place on foot. Many of these trails later became roads, and some became highways. The original travelers usually found the best routes. Religion. In Indian mythology, stories told to explain the mysteries of life, all animals, including humans, originated as brothers. In earlier times, the story said, they all talked with one another in the same language. The Indians of the 16th and 17th centuries respected the animals and did not kill them unnecessarily, unlike their Paleo-Indian ancestors of thousands of years before. When the Indians killed an animal to eat, they apologized to the animal's spirit, lest the spirit inflict them with harm. Animal spirits were seen as capable of causing disease. Perhaps they noticed that eating spoiled meat caused sickness. Plants were viewed as friendlier to humans, providing many medicines for cure of illness. Shamans or medicine men were skilled in the art of dealing with the many spirits, good and evil, that inhabited the forest. They knew about medicines that were actually helpful, but also used charms and magical maneuvers, dancing, chanting, and rattling gourds to bring about a cure. While Indians believed in many good and evil spirits, they believed in one creator, or great spirit, or creative force. The sun was a mighty symbol of that creative force. The fire here on earth was also symbolic of the deity. Indians' spiritual life was fully combined with their natural life and with nature itself. Many rituals were concerned with purity, and some with beginning again. One of the most important ceremonies for the Cherokee, and for many other tribes, was the green corn ceremony. It celebrated the new corn crop, and the villagers used it as an occasion for washing away all impurities and getting a new start. Houses were cleaned, worn-out clothes were burned, old cooking pots replaced with new. All fires were put out, and a priest kindled a new one, symbolizing new beginnings. Each family relit its fire from the priest fire. At this time, marriages could be dissolved and crimes pardoned. Music and dance often had religious meaning. They were performed to call forth magical powers or visions, to heal the sick, and to ensure a bountiful harvest. They also were used to observe the rites of passage, from childhood to adulthood, or from life to death. Drums, cane flutes, clappers, rattles, and whistles accompanied the singing and chanting. Sometimes the performances lasted through the night, aided by hallucinogens, substances that cause people to see or sense things that aren't real. Storytelling was also an important part of ceremonies. In societies without written records, storytelling was the means of passing on the history, legends, and myths that held the people together. Games and recreation. Indians valued a life lived with dignity, and they were serious about dying properly, with courage and honor. But this did not mean they did not know how to have fun. Music and dancing were important in their lives, but not always serious. Indians were great game players and athletes. Running and racing were popular among children and young men. Ball games were popular, especially one played with a racket that is the ancestor of today's lacrosse game. Large numbers of players were on the field at one time, and play was rough. Broken bones were not uncommon. Perhaps an even more significant game for warriors was the game of chunky. Every village had a chunky yard, a smooth area perhaps 100 feet long enough to roll a disc-like stone for a good distance. Players would throw javelins to where they thought the stone would stop. The chunky stones were so carefully made and polished they were almost works of art. Serious gambling accompanied the game, and the competition was fierce. It was not uncommon for a player to wager all his material goods on the game. Social organization. The clan, extended family, was the basic unit of social organization in Native American society. If you lived in that society, your clan identification would depend on your mother. This is called a matrilineal society, one in which ancestry is traced through the mother. The European society that was soon to intrude upon the Indians was patrilineal. The Indian father had to be from a different clan because marriage within the clan was forbidden. This was to prevent marriage of close relatives. The overall organization of Native American society was the tribe. The tribe included many clans. Later, a tribe was sometimes called a nation. Nation is a European term for a central political organization of people of a similar cultural, language, and geographic background. Of the 30 to 50 tribes in South Carolina in the 17th century, some were large and powerful, like the Cherokee, Westo, and Savannah. Some were small and weak. The Yemassee were a medium-sized tribe that only arrived in South Carolina after the English came to Charleston. The Yemassee were fierce warriors, but they were looking for neighbors friendlier than the Spanish farther south. In one tribe, the Sioux in the coastal zone, a chief seemed to have the power of life or death over the little nation, but that was unusual. In most tribes, the government structure was rather loose and individuals had a fair amount of autonomy, independence. It was common for a tribe to have several chiefs at the same time. They were leaders who governed by persuasion, not by coercion. The aim was to have harmony in the society, and decisions were usually made through discussion leading to a consensus, general agreement. The chiefs were usually older men, but not always. Sometimes there were women chiefs. Always, women were engaged in the discussions and decision-making process. The system of justice within a tribe was usually carried out by the clans. Both crime and punishment were the collective responsibility of the clan. If you committed a crime, your whole clan was responsible for it. If you were the victim of a crime, your clan was responsible for punishing the criminal or his clan. The punishment was usually exact retaliation, that is, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. If you committed murder, the victim's family was coming after you, or perhaps your brother or uncle. The death of any one of your clan members could satisfy the victim clan's need for retaliation. crimes of one person against another within the same clan were unthinkable. Such crimes were so unusual that Indians had no formal method of dealing with them. War. Wars between Indian tribes were fairly common. Like the justice system, wars were often retaliation for some wrong one tribe thought another tribe had caused. The wars were not major affairs with large armies attacking each other. The fighting was often by foes who were hidden from each other by trees or rocks. Bravery and honor did not require marching through open fields toward an opposing army, as Europeans of the era did. Europeans eventually learned a lot about warfare from the Indians. Usually, war parties were no more than 20 or 30 men moving swiftly to accomplish a surprise attack. The aim was to take revenge. Often to take a few scalps or prisoners was all that was necessary to satisfy the aim. Never was total destruction of another tribe on the agenda. The role of women. Women worked very hard in Indian society. They were keepers of the household, tending the young children, growing the garden, cooking, and making the pottery, baskets, blankets, clothes, and mats. They had the major responsibility of farming the village land, though they usually got some help from men at planting and harvest seasons. But all was not drudgery. As we have seen, women were able to take part in village and tribal decision-making. They could speak and be as persuasive as men, and, in rare instances, become chiefs in their tribe. For better or for worse, the marriages of Indian couples were not necessarily permanent. Either partner could break the family tie. This gave the Indian woman a great deal of freedom that women in many cultures did not have. Leaving a husband, being without a meat provider, might seem risky. But in Indian society, if food was available, everyone ate, unless they refused to work. Members of the clan and the tribe took care of one another. Childhood. A newborn baby would be taken to a stream or spring and washed and rubbed with bear oil even before being allowed to suckle. The child spent most of infancy strapped onto a cradle board. This was supposed to cause the child to grow into a strong and straight adult. In some tribes, the baby's head would be strapped to the board to shape the skull in a desired fashion. After infancy, children were given a great amount of freedom and very little physical punishment. Girls were tended and provided guidance by the mother and the women of the village. Boys, after about age 5, were supervised by the mother's brother and other males in her family. The main disciplinary device was ridicule, which worked quite well in a very small community. The girls learned to become women by helping with the household tasks. They could keep the fires burning, learn to make pottery, and work in the garden. The boys learned to become men by hunting birds and other small animals with bow and arrow and blowgun. Running was very important to hunting and warfare, so foot races were good training for speed and endurance. Wrestling was popular. Boys also competed to see who could tolerate the most pain without flinching. Maybe this is why physical punishment would not be very effective. The freedom children enjoyed ended abruptly with the initiation into adulthood, which was often severe, especially for boys. This rite of passage from childhood to adulthood consisted of a period of several days, weeks, or even months of cruel treatment and abuse, fasting, taking vile and powerful medicines, and perhaps worst of all, being subjected to lectures. But when it was over, the boy came out of it battered, bruised, exhausted, and starving, but now a young warrior. He might advance in reputation by valiant fighting and become an elite warrior, or perhaps, if wise enough, even become a chief. Do you remember? 1. Define in sentence form, maize, wigwam, matrilineal. 2. What were the two principal means of travel for Native Americans? 3. What was likely to happen to a Native American man who committed a crime?